Lecture 29, Science and Technology in Pre-Modern Asia.
Hello, it's good to be with you again. I tend to interpret the category of great minds rather broadly. So instead of making this a course simply on Asian philosophy or religion, I've included a few historians, some political theorists, and literary figures. I've also devoted some time to a Persian scientist, Al-Biruni, and the Indian origins of Arabic numerals. But there are other Asian mathematicians and scientists to consider. In this lecture, I'll introduce you to a few of the most prominent of these men, and along the way, we'll give some thought to the question of why modern Western-style science didn't develop in Asia. Exciting things were happening in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries in terms of trade, the economy, political consolidation, religious freedom, and technological advances. In the year 1620, the British philosopher Francis Bacon identified three inventions that seemed to drive much of this progress: printing, gunpowder, and the magnetic compass. He didn't realize at the time, though, that each of those three had originated in China. Now, you may have heard that for most of history, China was significantly more technologically advanced than the West. That's absolutely true. A list of devices or processes that were invented in China and then made their way West, especially during the Crusades or the time of the Mongols, would include the rotary winnowing machine, the crank, piston bellows, the seed drill, an efficient harness for draft animals, the crossbow, deep drilling, the chain pump, canal lock gates so that you can move ships from a body of water to another if they're not on the same level, segmented arch bridges, suspension bridges, silk manufacturing, this goes on, right? Porcelain, woodblock printing, watertight compartments in ships, the stern post rudder, and even stirrups. They were probably developed by nomadic tribes just outside of China. So imagine, no Greek or Roman cavalry was ever anchored to their horses with stirrups, which make it much easier to get on a horse and to stay on a horse while you're fighting. Sometimes there was a significant lag between when China came up with an invention and then when it was adopted in the West. China had cast iron, for instance, in the 4th century BC, so you could pour molten iron into molds and make weapons or tools. It first shows up in Europe in the late 14th century. Okay, in the meantime, Europeans made do with blacksmiths and individually crafted wrought iron pieces, right, that had to be hammered out one at a time. Wheelbarrows were used in China since the 2nd century, and they don't appear in Europe until 1,000 years later, even though you don't have to see too many wheelbarrows to go home and be able to put one together. There weren't a lot of people going back and forth from China and to Europe at that time. Sometimes people ask, so did anything go in the other direction? You know, anything from west to east? There were some Muslim mathematics and astronomy that came to China during the Mongol period, but that's about it, not a lot. A problem for this lecture, however, is that the great minds behind many of these technological breakthroughs are today anonymous, or nearly so. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, the astronomer Michael Hart wrote a fun book called The 100, a ranking of the most influential persons in history. It's fun, that is, if you like to argue. His top three, in order, are number one, Muhammad, and then Isaac Newton, and Jesus. Okay, now, some of you may ask, why doesn't the founder of the world's largest religion come in at number three and not number one? Hart argues that Jesus, unlike Muhammad, was not both a religious and a political leader, so he had only a local impact. It took St. Paul, that's his influential person number six, in order to bring Christianity into the Greco-Roman world and make it a universal religion rather than just a Jewish reform movement, right? You get the idea here. The most surprising thing in Hart's book, though, comes near the beginning of his list. So, once again, in order, top 10, starting with number one, Muhammad, then Newton, Jesus, Buddha, Confucius, St. Paul, Tsai Lun, Gutenberg, Columbus, and Einstein. Okay, one person in there may stand out to you. Do you have any idea who Tsai Lun is? Okay, and the preferred spelling now, Hart spells it another way, but it's spelled C-A-I, which is Tsai, and then Lun is L-U-N. Okay, who is that guy, and why does he make the top 10 list of most influential people ever? Cai Lun died in 121 AD. He was a eunuch at the court of the Emperor He of the Han Dynasty. In 105, he presented to the emperor a process for manufacturing paper, okay, a process that involved tree bark and old rags and fishnets and hemp. And paper was a writing material that was much lighter than bamboo slips that the Chinese had been writing on, and much cheaper than silk, which was another writing material. And the world was never the same thereafter, especially when paper was combined with printing in the 8th century in China. Now, sometimes historians add paper as a fourth great Chinese invention to Bacon's list of printing, gunpowder, and the compass. Unfortunately, we don't know much more about Cai Lun or his other ideas. Just to complete the story of paper, in 751, so shortly before the devastating An Lushan Rebellion in China, there were Chinese troops that were fighting with Arabs in Talas, which is in present-day Kyrgyzstan. The Arabs won, and some of the prisoners of war, the Chinese prisoners of war, knew how to make paper. So the Arabs put them to work doing that. And then within a few years, paper was being made in Baghdad in the Abbasid Caliphate. Paper didn't get into Europe until the 13th century, when the first paper mill was established in Italy. So one problem is that although we know of wonderful inventions and discoveries in Asia, many of the thinkers responsible were unknown craftsmen or artisans, perhaps not even literate, who passed their ideas down to family members or to apprentices by word of mouth. Now, Cai Lun was educated, but we hardly know anything about him or his methods. Another difficulty is that what these intelligent, observant, creative people were doing was not exactly science as we might define it today. There are lots of arguments about exact definitions, but in general, we might describe science as an endeavor to understand the natural world in a systematic, rational, cumulative, verifiable way, especially as it employs experimentation, measurement, and mathematics. Let's look at a great mind from the Han Dynasty China to see how his achievements might compare. We're going to talk about Zhang Heng, and he lived from 78 to 139. He was an astronomer, an inventor, a cartographer, a poet, and a statesman, and he was also a contemporary of Cai Lun. Zhang Heng was born in Henan, so it's a bit south of the Yellow River, and he was educated at the two capitals at the time, of Luoyang and Xi'an. He lived at the court for several years, where he was the chief astronomer, and then he was made a provincial administrator. Zhang Heng was famous for his lengthy rhapsodies on the two capitals, in addition to other poems. Somewhat unusually for a Chinese bureaucrat, Zhang Heng was very interested in the natural world. He cataloged some 2,500 stars in a star chart. He recalculated a more accurate value of pi. He invented a water-powered armillary sphere. Okay, now an armillary sphere is a set of bronze rings with markings that are set into a globe kind of shape so you can measure the location of stars. And he harnessed that to a hydraulic system so that the whole thing would turn at the same rate that the stars, okay, the sky appears to turn. It's the Earth that's turning, right? But so that this mechanism, this measuring device could sort of follow the stars through the course of an evening. He was also the first to design maps within a rectangular grid. So that gives a uniform scale for things, sort of like latitude and longitude. And he invented an odometer as well. Zhang Heng's most famous invention, though, was the world's first seismograph, which he presented to the emperor in 132. This was a bronze device shaped like a covered wine jar. It's actually quite large. It's like 6 feet across. It's huge. And it had eight dragons uniformly spaced around the side. Sorry. And each dragon faces down and has a ball in its mouth. And then underneath each dragon is a frog made of bronze with its mouth open. There's some sort of mechanism inside this, probably based on a pendulum, which swung in response to an earthquake tremor. And then, through some mechanical means, it releases one of the balls, which falls from a dragon's mouth into a frog's mouth below. Okay. Now, this really isn't a seismograph, since it's not writing anything. Maybe we should call it a seismometer. And it doesn't measure the strength of an earthquake. Instead, it reveals the direction from which the shock waves came, the epicenter. And the official records report that no one had ever seen anything like this before. And then comes this story from the official Chinese history. On one occasion, one of the dragons let fall a ball from its mouth, though no perceptible shock could be felt. All the scholars at the Capitol were astonished at this strange effect occurring without any evidence of an earthquake to cause it. But several days later, a messenger arrived bringing news of an earthquake in Gansu province, about 400 miles to the northwest. Upon this, everyone admitted the mysterious power of the instrument. There's no question as to Zhang Heng's brilliance, but is it science? Zhang Heng isn't really interested in the movement of the earth for its own sake. His seismometer is suited to mandate of heaven theories. Remember that earthquakes, along with floods and eclipses and comets and such, were regarded as portents of heaven's displeasure with human failings. So when there's an earthquake, you want to find out where it originated so that you can send a team of auditors there to root out corruption, because heaven is responding to some sort of human failings there. And what do you know? Most of the time, if you send in a team of auditors, they can find some sort of problems. So there are deep religious meanings, or in China, it's quasi-religious meanings, to these devices that we would see as purely natural or mechanistic. This was also the case with pre-modern astronomy, both in China and India, which is not scientific in the way we think of it, but it's very much tied to the heavens and the gods. I'm going to jump now to India, to a man named Aryabhatta. He lived from 476 to 550, so he's at the end of the Gupta Empire. Aryabhatta spent some time in Pataliputra, this is on the Ganges River, the capital, and because that wasn't far from Nalanda University, there's some speculation that Aryabhatta might have been associated with that institution. At least we know that they were studying astronomy at Nalanda. At the age of 23, he wrote the Aryabhatiya. Okay, the name of this is connected to his own name. And this is a book written in that terse sutra form of just some sentences, brief sentences, which summarized Hindu mathematics up to his time, including arithmetic, algebra, and plane and spherical trigonometry. Aryabhatta proposed the solution of a general quadratic equation, and he estimated the value of pi at 62,832 divided by 20,000, which works out to 3.1416. Okay, pi is actually 3.141592, and then it goes on because it's an irrational number, but very close approximation. He also included some of his ideas about astronomy, which he then elaborated in later works. Aryabhatta believed that the moon and the planets shone by reflected sunlight. I think he thought the stars were reflected sunlight as well. That didn't turn out, but the other one is a great guess. He also believed that lunar eclipses were caused by the shadow of the Earth. And although he followed the standard geocentric model of planetary movement, the Earth is in the center and the planets and the sun go around, he nevertheless suggested that the apparent rotation of the heavens was due to the axial rotation of the Earth. That was a little too much for his successors, but he's on to something. He estimated the sidereal rotation period of the Earth, right, the period of a day, at 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds, which is almost exactly the modern measurement. And he estimated the sidereal year, so this is the time it takes the Earth to orbit the sun, at least in our terms, a full year, however you're going to explain the mechanism, with respect to the fixed stars. He estimated that at 365 days, 6 hours, and 12 minutes, which is only about 3 minutes too long. In India, there were many commentaries written on the Aryabhatiya, as was common with the sutras. Remember, like the Yoga Sutra, just these very short aphoristic statements, and then lots of commentaries to explain them. And his book was translated into Arabic around the year 800, so it influenced Muslim scholars in the West as well. Al-Biruni, for example, knew Aryabhatta's work. Okay. India loves this guy. The first Indian satellite, which was launched in 1975, was named the Aryabhatta, and the satellite even appeared on the 2-rupee banknote from 1976 to 1997, when they put Gandhi on every denomination of currency. Okay. So, again, our question, is this science? We're closer. Aryabhatta is doing mathematical, verifiable astronomy, and later Indian scholars will critique and build upon his work. Yet perhaps we're distorting his efforts by simply pulling out facts that match up with our own scientific discoveries. The Aryabhatiya is a Hindu work. It begins with an invocation of Brahman and an estimation of the long Hindu cycles of creation and destruction. Aryabhatta talks about the location of hell and about how the movement of the stars would appear to the gods. Aryabhata is interested in astronomy, at least partly, because of its close association with the calendar, which was a crucial element in Hindu religious practices. Okay. At this point, let's jump forward by half a millennium and over to China again for one of the most intriguing minds in Asian history. His name is Shengguo, or it's Shengkuo. This is an romanization issue. There's the same Chinese character, can be pronounced two ways. We're going to call him Shengguo. Shengguo lived from 1031 to 1095 in the Song Dynasty, so he's a contemporary of the Neo-Confucian scholar Zhou Dunyi. Remember the diagram of the Great Ultimate? Okay. At the time that Zhou Dunyi was talking about this sort of alchemical Taoist sort of thing, Shengguo is doing something a lot more closely based in nature. He was born in Hangzhou, in the Yangtze River Delta in East China. Sheng's father was a low-level provincial official, and his first teacher was his mother. Women were never widely educated in China, but a few girls were educated privately by their fathers in their families, and Shengguo was lucky enough to get one of those mothers. Sheng passed the civil service exams and served in a variety of government posts having to do with foreign relations, the military, education, hydraulic engineering, and finances. I'm actually reminded, Confucius once said, the gentleman is not a tool, by which he meant that you don't educate men for really narrow, specialized professions. He thought that this sort of moral training that he was giving would suit someone to do all sorts of things. And that's certainly what happens in Imperial China, is people who pass the civil service exams are bright in a variety of ways. And this is Shengguo. He's also the head of the Bureau of Astronomy for some time. Because Sheng was associated with some of the highest offices and officials of the day, we know quite a bit about his life. He gets involved in some very high-profile political fights. We also have the Dream Pool Essays, which is a book Sheng wrote during a period of forced retirement after he was involved in a military disaster. Okay. This book, Dream Pool Essays, includes 507, actually very short, little sort of random jottings, thoughts or observations, and some of Sheng's ideas about governmental affairs, about music and art and ritual, but also about astronomy and medicine and mathematics. Shengguo was the first to describe a magnetic needle compass, and he discovered that true north was a few degrees off from magnetic north. Sheng suggested using predatory insects as a form of agricultural pest control. He reported how when he was at the Bureau of Astronomy, he had calculated that the pole star had moved about 3 degrees over the last 500 years, right? The North Star seems to move because of the precession of the equinoxes. He also noted a contemporary who had invented movable type printing that used baked clay type. Okay. The Chinese later used metal type, actually a little bit after the Koreans had first developed this, but it never really took hold in China because of Chinese characters. There are about 50,000 Chinese characters. They don't use all of them, but you need 3,000-4,000 to sort of for basic use. And so in the West, when Gutenberg is doing metal type, he only needs, well, to use an English example, you need 26 letters, uppercase, lowercase, some spaces, some punctuation, you're good to go. In China, you would need to have metal type for thousands and thousands of characters. So woodblock printing is actually more efficient. You can just sort of cut out the wood around different characters, and it works great. Okay, back to Shengguo. He also did things with his hand, as well as with his mind. He constructed several relief maps, which is kind of a new thing. He conducted optical experiments with mirrors. He was pretty interested in inverted images on concave mirrors. He did some experiments to try to figure out what caused rainbows. He invented a new type of writing ink, and he improved astronomical tools such as the armillary sphere, water clocks, sighting tubes, and the gnomon. Okay, the gnomon is the part of a sundial that casts a shadow. Sheng discovered fossils and correctly guessed at their origins, and he hypothesized about long-time changes in climate and geology, including erosion. Actually, it's worth a little more detail. He found some petrified bamboo in an area where bamboo didn't grow at all, and he thought, the land there, the area there, must once have been lower with more humidity so that bamboo actually grew there once upon a time. Oh, and he was a poet too, of course. Everybody does poetry who's educated in China. Clearly, Shengguo was an observant, clever, and curious about nearly everything. And that may be part of the problem. I've pulled out the items that seem scientific by modern standards, but they're all mixed up with different kinds of jottings about supernatural occurrences and court gossip. For example, Shun tells a story about how he and a friend went to test a witch who had a reputation for being able to answer questions about anything, things even hundreds of miles away. When they got to where she was, and she does this as a spirit medium, people are playing the board game Go, which is like, it's sort of like chess. It's a strategy game. So Shun and his friends counted out some black and white playing pieces and then put them in their hands and asked her how many they had in their hands. She could tell them exactly, but when they just grabbed some pieces at random, the numbers that she gave were wrong when they counted them up afterwards. So clearly, Shun thought, this woman can read minds, but if we don't know ourselves how many pieces we've got in our hands, then she doesn't know either. She could, though, correctly identify the contents of a cloth-covered box. And there were several demonstrations of this, but he says when his friend presented a large box with copies of the Diamond Sutra in it, she said, that box is empty. And then he opened up and said, no, you're wrong. There's all of these scriptures here, the perfection of wisdom scriptures. And the spirit that was speaking through her after a long pause said, it's nothing but an empty box. You can't trick me. And Shangua then concluded by remembering that according to Buddhism, the truest words are indeed emptiness. Do you remember the story about Xuanzang, who went to India, got the scriptures and the rolls are empty, and then he goes back, at least according to the novel that was written later on about that. Given so much mathematics, careful observation of the natural world, and technological achievement, the question naturally arises as to why the scientific and industrial revolutions didn't happen in Asia, or especially in China, instead of Europe. It's easy enough to come up with plausible-sounding answers, reflecting the political and religious, economic, and social differences between those two regions. For instance, it's been suggested that Western science was a response to the Judeo-Christian idea that nature has laws. There are natural laws that were designed by a rational, personal creator, and that human beings, because they share some rationality, can discover those laws. Or it might be that the centralized, unified government of China lacked the regional competitiveness that motivated England and France and Holland and Spain to try to get ahead of each other through military advances in technology. Or was it that creative tension between church and state that seemed to be so dynamic? Some people, some scholars, have argued that mechanization wasn't required in societies with large populations and a surplus of labor, or that Asia had a more harmonious approach to nature rather than an instrumental attitude. Remember in Genesis, when God told Adam and Eve to subdue the earth and have dominion over all its creatures. Or was Confucianism the problem, with its orthodoxy and emphasis on bureaucracy and human morality? And Confucianism has some direct notions of the types of pursuits that a proper gentleman should and shouldn't pursue. Or maybe it was the caste system in India, that Brahmins, who were educated and were intelligent, working with their minds, they wouldn't want to work with their hands like someone from a lower caste would. Maybe. I mean, actually, the deeper you get into this particular question, the more complex it is, because scholars can't even agree on what caused the scientific revolution in the West, let alone what didn't cause it elsewhere. The best analysis of this issue that I've seen is Nathan Sivens' essay, Why the Scientific Revolution Did Not Take Place in China, or Didn't It?, which was first published in 1982 and then updated by Sivens more than 20 years later. It's available online. Sivens makes two points. The first is that this is not the kind of question that historical research can answer conclusively. He also points out that there was a scientific revolution of sorts in China in the 18th century having to do with astronomy, but it didn't lead to the types of social changes that we would expect, which probably means our expectations about patterns of scientific progress need to be re-examined. The story is, when Chinese astronomers learned from Westerners that the Earth actually went around the sun, they were able to adjust their traditional methods and tools accordingly. But that new knowledge didn't lead to the kind of cultural upheaval that the West saw with Galileo and Copernicus. Sivens cites the example of Shangua and observes that if his essays are a jumble of things that we might call proto-scientific and superstitious. He's not making the same distinctions that we would make. Shun also doesn't grasp that knowledge might be systematically interrelated, that medicine might have something to do with astronomy and mathematics and alchemy, that a unifying philosophy or approach might bring all of those things together. Actually, I'm also reminded that Newton, as much as we celebrate him as a man of science, was also interested in biblical prophecies and such. The strict distinctions that we make now took a while in the West to develop. And in Asia, they just don't. A problem, though, is an unspoken assumption when we ask this question. Why didn't the scientific revolution happen in China? There's an assumption that a scientific revolution is inevitable, that it's simply it's part of a natural course of human progress. And if China or India or Islamic lands didn't reach that point, then there must have been something wrong with them. I think it might be closer to the truth to regard the development of Western science as an anomaly in human history, as a unique event that was almost completely unpredictable, that might well have never happened, though I'm certainly grateful that it did, whatever its causes. In any case, at the time that Europeans first started showing up regularly in Asia in the 16th century, so you've got the Portuguese coming to India, Jesuit missionaries in China and in Japan, at that period, Europeans were facing large, wealthy, powerful states. There's the Mughal Empire in India, remember Akbar the Great, the Ming Dynasty in China. They built the Great Wall. They kicked out the Mongols. They were afraid the Mongols might come back, so they built the Great Wall that you see now. And then in 1644, the Ming Dynasty was replaced by the even more impressive Qing Dynasty under the Manchus. And then in Japan at the time, they were in the process of political consolidation by Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, and Tokugawa Ieyasu. In that case, Christians, Jesuits in Japan, made some initial successes, but then after the country was unified, Christianity was banned entirely, and foreigners were expelled. This is in the early years of the Tokugawa shogunate, which began in 1603. Okay, so Europeans are facing these very powerful and strong regimes in Asia, and at least at the beginning, Europeans don't have much to offer, at least technologically speaking. When Vasco da Gama first sailed around Africa and landed in Calicut, that is on the west coast of India, in 1498, he brought out his diplomatic gifts. There were striped cloth, scarlet hoods, some hats, hand wash basins, some strings of coral, and then some sugar, some oil, and honey. The king in India looked at those gifts and he started laughing and he said, "Why don't you bring gold next time?" The Portuguese had found themselves in a sophisticated and highly lucrative trade network. This is the Indian Ocean trade network. And those people were used to dealing in silks and spices and jewels and porcelain. Europeans were desperate for Asian products. When Vasco da Gama returned back to Portugal and sold the goods that he'd acquired in India, he made a 3,000% profit. Okay, so goods had been going from India to Europe through Muslim middlemen who had been sort of jacking up the price all along the way. So there's all kinds of things that Europeans want from Asia. But there's really nothing that Europeans have that the East wants. As a result, Europeans become merchants/pirates. And when they sail down the coast of Africa, they traded there where they could, or they stole things, or they kidnapped people, so that when they arrived in India, they had gold and ivory and slaves on board that they could trade. And Vasco da Gama's expedition, this is four little ships of about 120 tons each with a few hundred men total, it doesn't hold a candle to the expeditions of the Chinese eunuch admiral Zheng He that the Chinese emperor had sent down the east coast of Africa a century earlier. The first of these voyages in 1405 included 53 large treasure ships, 255 smaller ships, and 28,000 men. Okay, imagine that armada sailing into your harbor if you're in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, let's say. And the big ships are the largest wooden vessels ever constructed. They displace about 2,000 tons. They're 400 feet long and 160 feet wide, so like a football field and a half. But Africa just didn't have anything to justify that sort of expense. Now, the Chinese could have gone to Europe, probably. They had the technological capability to do so. They didn't know it was there. But even had they made it to Europe, they would never have gone back a second time. I mean, there was nothing that Europe had that was worth their while. But in the next few hundred years, there's dynamic change that happens in Europe. And by the 19th century, Europeans had military and industrial capacities that were far beyond anything that Asian empires had ever seen. Okay, this came as quite a shock. The Chinese, for example, had long regarded Europeans as ignorant, greedy barbarians. And in the next few lectures, we'll explore the different ways in which several great minds of the Eastern intellectual tradition sought to meet the challenge of the West and modernization.